This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
This is your current affairs program, The Rainbow Report, on Joy 94.9.
Good evening, this is Doug Pollard welcoming you to another magazine of news and current affairs for The Rainbow Crew. Tonight on The Rainbow Report, we'll be continuing our roundup of candidates for the post of mayor with Will Fowles, the non-Labour, Labour-ish candidate, offering what he calls a fresh vision for the city. Rodney Croom, if we can get through to him, muses on Barack Obama and the wave of protest sweeping the US after gay marriage was stopped in California and started up in Connecticut. Closer to home, John Wayne, general manager of The Market, helps us understand the impact of the Brumby government's latest attempts to control violence and drunkenness in the city. Will it be better or worse than the failed 2 a.m. lockout? Plus, we celebrate the launch of a new political party dedicated to countering the influence of the religious right and all other wowsers, fighting the proposed internet filter and supporting gay marriage. The Australian Sex Party has been launched at Sexpo today, and joining us in the studio later, we have its leader, Fiona Patton, who's also CEO of EROS, the Adult Entertainment Industry Business Association. And Kay Sera will be taking a look beneath the bonnet at World AIDS Day and some of the AIDS movies from years gone by. Lending me a hand, we have a mini Meet the Press with Andy Noonan from Southern Star and Andrew Shaw, editor of MCV. Nice cover this week, by the way, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Always like to be somewhere in the public eye, don't we? Well, the blood ban case in Tasmania is finally over. Now we have to wait for the verdict, which could be much as a year from now. And in the meantime, a spontaneous protest movement has sprung up across the US over the nullification of gay marriage in California. First of all, Andrew, what do you think's going on with this kind of sudden spontaneous wave of protest all across the US?
Yes, it's funny, isn't it? There was a clip on MCV online, and it showed a group of people in gay men predominantly in the Castro district chasing out some Mormons who'd come in, I think, to preach in the street. And it was interesting because the guys pursued these Christians all the way out of the Castro, which you probably know is like an inner city suburb of...
I've passed through there once or twice.
I've seen the video. The interesting thing was the comments on the site were such that it was saying, how could these gay people drive out this minority of Christian preachers? Don't they have any respect for other people's rights? But I think that's sort of, I can understand the anger there. Mm. I can understand the anger in, especially in the Castro.
It seems like such a mean-spirited act to repeal something that's already in effect, in process, 18,000 couples, and to sort of to bring that back and say, actually, you know what, we'll just whip that paper right out from under you and, you know, you're not legally married after all. I just think it's completely mean-spirited.
It is a bit. Rodney, we finally found you, I gather. Hello.
Hello, Doug. Hello.
We were just talking about the Proposition 8 situation in the US and the wave of protest that swept through. This is all quite remarkable, isn't it?
It was quite remarkable, the protests that have occurred. No one expected such a huge outcry against the referendum result in California. Although, if we look back at what happened in Australia in 2004, when the Howard government passed its amendment to the Marriage Act, which banned same-sex marriage, there was a similar kind of outpouring of anger on a much smaller scale. I'd never seen that many rallies and protests that well attended across the country. It had never occurred before.
Mm, but it all kind of faded away within a year or two, didn't it? Do you think this is going to do the same?
The National Day of Action that gave rise to still occurs, but you're right, of course, anger always fades, and people settle into something even if they don't like it. But still, I think there's a memory of that event in the minds of many LGBT people and their allies around the country, which, under the right circumstances, I think, can be mobilised again. And so even though we might see a diminution of anger in the United States about what happened in California, I've got no doubt that this will live in the memories of people for a very long time. And
we do tend to have very long memories, don't we? We do. I mean, we've seen that happening in Melbourne just at the moment because I don't know if you... Do you have Movember down in Tasmania where people grow moustaches for charitable purposes? And one of the charities this year, one is prostate cancer. It's all about men's health. And the other one is Beyond Blue, men's mental health. And a lot of people have been calling the station here, talking to the two fat lattes who are taking part in this, saying they're not going to be involved this year because it's Beyond Blue and Jeff Kennett. And they haven't forgotten what Jeff Kennett said.
Yes, well, once a product or a brand name or a company or even a place acquires a name for bigotry, then that does take a long time to wear off. I mean, even after our laws changed in Tasmania, there were still people who didn't want to come here and wouldn't buy Tasmanian produce because of their antipathy to the place in the 90s because of its anti-gay laws. And so, yeah, the Mormon Church in the United States, I think, has bought itself a reputation that it didn't expect, and that will survive for a long time.
You've heard some fairly unpleasant things, though, about what people on our side of the fence have been saying and doing. There were some complaints about, you know, elderly Mormon ladies being attacked and all this sort of thing, and also some racist stuff, because the other people who are getting blamed for this, of course, is the blacks, who apparently voted for Obama but not for gay marriage.
Yes, I can see why people, you know, blame the church, because it did donate so much money, and it was very specifically against the proposition, or for the proposition. In terms of black homophobia, that's not a black issue. That's a church issue. Many black voters still see homosexuality or same-sex marriage or whatever in a religious frame rather than in a civil rights frame. Mm-hmm. And that's a matter of education. If proponents of same-sex marriage, I think, had done a bit more work in that community, just reframing the issue so that black voters could see that, you know, it was a civil rights issue and that there were parallels with their own experience, particularly in terms of the prohibition on interracial marriages up until the 1960s, then that would have lessened that homophobia. It's not a black thing. Mm. It's a religious thing. And in general terms, yes, of course, you know, we shouldn't go around blaming people for the prejudices they have. We should just be looking at the prejudices themselves.
Yeah, and there's also been a certain amount of criticism about the effectiveness of the campaign that was run, no campaign that was run by the various gay organisations. Apparently the Mormon churches and everybody else were very much out there door knocking and leafleting and telephoning people, whereas the Human Rights Campaign and the other bodies involved on our side were not nearly so much on the ground.
It's easy in retrospect to say this was wrong and that was wrong, and I mean, I agree that some of the ads were pretty weak, but if you look at it another way, I mean, no gay rights campaign in the history of the universe has ever raised so much money in such a short time. Had such an incredible profile. Now, of course, it had to have to combat all that money from the Mormons, and ultimately it didn't succeed.
Yeah.
But as someone who, you know, works in this stuff all the time, I can see the point of view of the gay rights groups that they did put it in the Titanic effort.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to lose, really.
Yeah. Andy Noonan, you wanted to come in here.
Yeah, I've a multitude of questions, really, but the first one is, I'm not sure whether you can answer this, Rodney, but is there a situation that the US government, as on a federal level, could actually overturn what's gone on in California at all?
Not the US government as such. The US Supreme Court could. I had a conversation about this with Wayne Morgan, who's an expert in this kind of law, he studied it when he was studying in the United States. He's a senior sexuality law lecturer at Australian National University, and in his view, yes, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court could overturn the outcome of the referendum if it was found that it trespassed on the area of basic rights. Now, in Californian constitutional law, there are some basic rights, like the right to equality, which you simply cannot have a referendum on. And that's the basis of the challenge, the legal challenge that's gone up to the result, from a variety of different gay and lesbian rights groups and the Australian and the American Council for Civil Liberties, they've argued that you cannot, there should never have been a referendum on this basic human right, the right to equality before the law. And even if the California Supreme Court doesn't agree with that, the US Supreme Court does have the jurisdiction, and there are also precedents there, particularly in terms of Colorado, with Proposition 2 from a few years ago, of them saying, yes, you should never have had a referendum about that. This is struck down. So there are courses available and precedents there, and of course it depends on how many resources are available to pursue them.
Andrew Shaw, you wanted to come in here too.
Yes, Rodney, we've got an article at MCV this week talking about Proposition 8, and Stephen Jones is from the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. Points the finger at the apathy of the gay community towards this issue, both in the US and back here. Do you think that the gay community has become apathetic? He says that we rely on people like yourself to do the lobbying work for us.
You can't raise $30 million or whatever from an apathetic community. The campaign in California, from what I understand, mobilised thousands of people. Now, of course, in every minority community, there are going to be those who don't care or don't want to know, or feel that someone else will do the work. I guess after 20 years of activism myself, I feel like that's just part and parcel of human nature, not gay nature, human nature. And rather than complaining about the fact that not every gay person is out there fighting for their rights, making the most of those who will. Sorry if that sounds a bit resigned.
Well, I think you've earned the right to be after all this time, Rodney.
There's no point whinging about people who simply find an excuse not to be involved or have a legitimate reason not to be involved. We need to be mobilising as best we can and channeling the energy of those who are willing to do something. And I think if we do that properly, we've shown in the past that we can actually make progress.
Well, this certainly seems to have energised a lot of people, temporarily at least, in the US. I suppose it's a case of capitalising on that and trying to sort of surf that wave, as it were. You know, get some of these people who've temporarily come on board to stay fully on board.
Well, that's yes. Of course, not everyone who's attending rallies now in New York and no. Kansas City and all over the place will continue to be involved. But there will be people who, for the first time, have tasted the empowerment of speaking out, and they'll stay involved, and we just have to make sure that we're able to do the same thing in Australia, make sure that those who have the capacity to speak out will do, and carry the issue forward.
Andy.
Rodney, how much does this particular case have an impact on us here in Australia? I mean, apart from it being high profile, I mean, a gay marriage campaign is seeing this as a real blow.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Can you ask that question again?
The situation in California, how much impact does that actually have on us here in Australia? I mean, a campaign is seeing this as a real blow to the cause?
Well, obviously it's deeply hurtful and disappointing for those people who are directly affected in California. And in the United States as a whole, California is seen as a kind of bellwether state. If it can't succeed there, then maybe it can't succeed anywhere, at least for now. In Australia, it might give strength to those people who feel that marriage equality is a lost cause, or that civil unions, for instance, as a substitute for equal marriage, might be more winnable, and that we have to focus on that because marriage just won't, will never happen. I tend not to take such a short-term view of it. If we look at, for instance, to Canada or to the Netherlands or Spain, marriage equality there seemed a long way off at certain points as well. But with the concerted work of a lot of people, it became much more possible and then occurred much more quickly than people expected. So I'm eternally hopeful that this reform isn't as far off in Australia as many people think.
Oh, well, touch wood. Look, Rodney, before we let you go, the blood ban case, that's all over now. All we have to do is, like, wait for some kind of judgment to come out. Is that right?
The Yeah, we'll be waiting a while too.
Yeah, I gather it's going to be about a year or something. So.
Yeah, that's right. The final hearing was on Monday. Mm-hmm. The hearings have gone much longer than anyone expected,
yeah.
Because there was just such a huge quantity of information to present to the tribunal. And now, because of that huge quantity, it'll take them 6 to 12 months. Some people are saying it past 18 months to get through it all and come up with their final decision, because it's not just the medical material they need to get through, and there's a lot of that, but also there's a lot of legal submissions for them to work through. And to be honest, given the amount of material, and it runs to tens of thousands of pages, I'd be surprised if they didn't take a long time, and probably disappointed, because it is such a complex issue.
Yeah. Okay, Rodney, well, we will come back to you before 18 months are up and probably talk to you in a week or two's time about some other issues. In the meantime, thanks very much for your time tonight.
Thanks, Doug.
That was Rodney Croom there from the Australian Coalition for Equality down there in Tasmania.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Informing, entertaining and provoking, this is the Rainbow Report.
And this is Doug Pollard, your host for the evening. My helpers, my Santa's little elves this evening, Andy Noonan from Southern Star and Andrew Shaw from MCV. Before we go to our next guest, we've had a few SMSs in here talking about the Proposition 8 being voted down in California. This highlights how court-appointed law can be challenged. It's far better to get legislative reform, says John. Well, there's arguments on both sides of that one, and this next one I will read out in the context of introducing my next guest. Now, the arrival of a new political party is usually followed fairly swiftly by its departure, but the Australian Sex Party probably has a better chance than most of getting up. Launched today, it's already come under attack from the Australian Christian lobby, who claim it supports the exploitation and degradation of women through pornography and prostitution. And given that it's backed by what we politely call the adult entertainment industry, some of you might agree. With me in the studio is the convener of the party and CEO of the Eros Association, the sex trade equivalent of, say, I don't know, Real Estate Institute of Victoria, Fiona Patton. Good evening, Fiona.
Good evening, Doug.
Now, I've just had an SMS here saying it's pronounced Eros, not Eros, Italian. Well, I'm British and I say Eros.
Well, as long as you don't say Eros, which we get quite a lot as well.
I'm sure you do. So, why a political party, Fiona?
Well, as you said in your introduction, we're from the Eros Association, which has been, for the last 20 years, been lobbying on sex and censorship issues. And, you know, with a degree of success, I think we've managed to keep some of the tide at bay. But there's really been a sense that there's been this incredible conservative creep coming into politics, state and federal, not only in Australia, of course, but internationally. And mm-hmm. I think certainly the internet filter and the ISP filter was the final straw. We just went, right, look, you know, we need to provide a voice in Parliament. Seeing the sort of the likes of Senator Fielding in federal Parliament, seeing the likes of Fred Nile in New South Wales, and mm-hmm. the power that they have welded or, you know, had mm-hmm. In distracting politicians from the main game. Yeah, has been our reason.
It's like I said in the, I did a little bit of a pre-introduction to the show earlier on today, and I said, you know, it's picking up on a point you made. Everything we hear about sex from politicians seems to be no, seems to be anti, mm-hmm. seems to be sex mm-hmm. equals bad. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't hear very much about the
positive. Politicians don't have sex, you know.
Well, maybe they don't. That's not what I generally hear.
That's
not what I
hear.
Even if it is.
If you listen to their spiel, you would think
that's
they never
right.
do.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Whereas in point of fact, they're going around sniffing chairs and doing all kinds of strange things.
Well, I suspect they're not unlike you or me, although I've never sniffed a chair. But, but they do, you know.
Exactly.
They do what nature intended.
Yes. So, you know, they must think that there's more votes in pandering to anti-sex feeling yeah. than pro-sex feeling.
But, you know,
I don't understand that.
It's strange that it's to them it's that important vote mm. that it's the people who are against you know, progressive sex policy, be it, you know, sexuality, gender, or censorship, it's the ones who are negative who are much more, who will possibly change their vote. Mm. You know, the 80% of us who really think whatever other people do in their own bedroom is their own business, we may not change our vote. And I've heard that from politicians many times saying, yes, Fiona, I understand. I mean, 80% of the population's on your side. I totally agree with you. But there's that 8% of my electorate that's going to get up in arms. But if I speak out on this policy, and they might vote me out.
Yeah,
I mean, the Australian Christian Lobby has said that one of the reasons why this shouldn't be allowed to happen, it shouldn't be, you know, Australian sex parties, because it's degrading. Pornography is degrading to women. What would you say to that sort of criticism?
Well, I don't agree with it for the first half, but I also kind of think it's really curious that they never speak about the men. You know, they never mention the men that are in the films.
Because they've probably never seen gay porn, I don't know. Oh, you mean in straight porn?
Even in straight porn as well, Andrew. All right. Even in straight porn as well, there's some men involved. I know we have a lot. But you know, it's certainly in gay porn as well. I mean, I don't know that they just think the blokes are lucky and the women are unlucky. But I don't agree with that. I think because they have such a negative position on sex, and they have so much guilt and shame on sex, that's why they think it's objectifying, because they use that as a negative context. They don't say that we're objectifying footballers for sport, or we're objectifying, you know, anyone for other different things. You know, objectifying women because they have sex.
So you don't see it as exploitation in any way then?
Not at all. Not at all. I think, you know, certainly when you have laws that outlaw the making of a product, as we do in Australia, it's illegal to make an adult film here. Then you do open it up to exploitation. Then you do open it up to unsafe work practices and the like. But when you have a legal, well-run industry, then I don't see where the exploitation is.
So it's a bit like the same argument you get about tackling HIV, for example, where people say in countries where homosexuality and prostitution are illegal, it's much harder to fight HIV because it drives it underground. Mm-hmm. So are you saying, in effect, by making pornography illegal, it almost renders it exploitative because it pushes it into, let's say, criminal hands?
Well, I think it enables exploitation. Hmm. It certainly makes it a lot easier.
One of your policies I notice here is abolishing sex slavery and sexual servitude. Yeah, so that, can you explain what you mean by a non-morality-based immigration policy?
Well, it may be surprising to certainly some members of parliament, but a lot of sex workers who do come from other countries actually come here knowing that they're going to work in the sex industry. Mm. Unfortunately, because they can't come to Australia and say on their visa, I would like to work in a brothel in Sydney or in Melbourne, they have to go through an agent. They then pay an enormous amount of money to that agent. So they then arrive in Australia with a debt because they can't legally come to Australia. Mm. So I'd like to see it the same as, you know, you can employ a chef or a builder from another country to come and work in Australia legally. Why shouldn't we be able to do the same with sex workers? And I think that cuts out the exploitation. That cuts out so many of the people who are putting these women, sort of saying, yes, you arrived with a $30,000 debt. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, then all of a sudden it's 60.
We've got a couple of SMSs in here. This is from Adam. He wants to know, Fiona, what's the core philosophy of the sex party? And why did you choose that name? Wouldn't the Freedom of Choice party be less exclusive? Most people will think about sex parties. It's a dodgy name at best. And Will says something of the same thing. It saddens me that the Australian Sex Party, whose policies and mandates are so aligned with my own, have come up with such a horrendous name for their organisation. How do they expect to be taken seriously with a moniker like that?
Yes. Look, I got that from my own industry. In fact, probably the biggest criticism we got from the name was, you know, adult shop owners and staff saying, oh, you don't want to use sex to sell sex, do you? You know, God. You know? But really, we thought long and hard about it, and we thought, you know, one of the things that Don Chipp said to me, and he's a man that I hugely admire. He said the hardest thing that political parties have in front of them is getting attention. Mm-hmm. You know, they can have the best policies. They can have everything. But do you think the media wants to listen to them? And I honestly think if we came out as the, you know, the Liberal Democracy Party or the, you know, Freedom of Choice Party or... You know, the
but this is what the Christian side of things have always done. They've always hidden themselves behind nice anodyne-sounding names,
right.
Because they call themselves things like the Family Research Association,
exactly.
Or the Australian Family
yes.
Association,
that's
and,
right.
And all those sort of things.
That's right.
Without, you know, they don't put their purple on in public, so to
well,
speak.
You know, and in some ways, there was some freedom of choice issues that I didn't really feel comfortable in being the front person for. I mean. If freedom of choice, that's about that could be about guns, you know, it could be about a whole range of issues that we didn't feel that we felt that we had quite a good range of issues that all dealt with sex and gender that we wanted to deal with. So that's, and then there was the slightly cheeky side of this is that, you know, 15% of people walk into a polling booth and don't know who they're going to vote for. So, okay, you've got the Labour Party, you've got the Liberal Sensible Party, you've got the Socialist Party and the Sex Party. You know? We may get some donkey votes.
Well, I think you'll certainly get the Corey Worthington vote, I think.
The Indian Business Week contacted me yesterday and asked me whether we had Shane Warne on board.
That's only for your SMS campaign.
That's right.
Well, what exactly are you going to do? You're going to run candidates in the Senate, in the House, in local elections? Where are you aiming at?
Initially, we're aiming strictly for the Senate and the upper houses in the states. In the houses of review.
Mm-hmm.
We're not looking to make government, but we are looking to make them make sense. And certainly when you look at the makeup of the Senates and of the upper houses, I mean, Victoria's got the DLP back in the upper house.
And, of course, we have the aforementioned Senator Fielding.
And we have,
Canberra,
that's
yes.
right. So I think it's time to, that there's room for other voices in that house of review. And it does seem like the upper houses are becoming very much the house where social policy, social issues is really being debated and argued out. In the lower houses, it's less so.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there, Fiona. No doubt we could actually probably do a whole show with the talking
well,
on this topic.
That's right.
But we've got a few more things to get through. Thank you very much for joining us.
Or?
I was going to say, let us know, how do we get in touch with you? Where's your website?
I know it's cheeky, but www.sexparty.org.au.
Well, that's easy enough to remember. Sexparty.org, how appropriate, .au. That's Fiona there from the Australian Sex Party.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station.
This is your current affairs program, The Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9.
Yes, you're listening to The Rainbow Report, and this is Doug Pollard here, your host for the evening. You can SMS us. Quite a few of you have done so. So let's catch up on some of that before we move on. Don from Paran says, why is the GLBTI community always so reactive to fundamentalists? Why don't we go on the attack for a change? For example, raising proposals to tax the church. Well, yeah, I think that'd be great. I'd love to see Sanitarium paying tax on their Weet-Bix, for example. Never mind taxing the church. But anyway, we have to move on here. Now, regular listeners to the show will know we've been working our way through, if I can say that in this context, some of the candidates for the Mayor of Melbourne. And we welcome Will Fowles. Hello, Will.
G'day. How's it going?
Hello.
It's
Hi.
Going very well, thank you very much. More to the point, how's it going for you?
Oh, look, it's going all right. We're having a lot of... a lot of terrific feedback from all the voters we've been speaking to over the course of the last few months, and it's proving to be an interesting campaign.
Now, it says here, you're a hotelier.
Yes.
So, obviously, all this nightlife and alcohol problem and all that is very much in your bailiwick.
Indeed.
Look, you've got a close personal interest.
Oh, sure. Look, we come at this issue as licensees, which makes us unique in this campaign for the Lord Mayoral candidate anyway. And we've formed the view at the outset, one, that 2 a.m. didn't work, and I'm very glad to see that the state government has backed away from that position. But also that part of the solution in this is licensees working together to raise the bar on the responsible service of alcohol standard. Now, my venue fits 700 people in it. We typically don't have any incidents in any given month. There are other 700-person venues around the place that have lots of incidents, including some horrific ones, which you all know about in recent times. And the reality is that it is possible for licensees to lift the bar. It is possible for licensees to not serve people who are intoxicated. The rules around intoxication are well written, and they're pretty clear, and I'd suggest that there are a few larger operators who are doing it badly and a bunch of little operators who are doing it well.
Well, there's been a lot of buck passing on this issue, as far as I can tell, from, you know, reading reports in the press, because you get... The obvious question is, if responsible service of alcohol is working, how come drunk people get drinks? And I've asked that question of quite a lot of people, licensees and also some of the other candidates, and the answers have varied from, well, it's not really the drink, it's the drugs, and we don't control that, or it's been they're getting liquored up at the takeaways and so on before they come in or after they come in, or they're bringing their own drink, smuggling their own drink in.
Well,
there's a whole range of kind of issues there. How can you make responsible service of alcohol work?
Well, the RSA standards, as I say, are good standards. There are lots of markers for whether or not people are in fact intoxicated. And I might add that intoxication isn't just about alcohol. Mm. Intoxication can be from any drug. So it's really important that licensees train their staff to identify the signs of intoxication. Now, if someone turns up to a venue liquored up, they simply shouldn't get served. Someone takes drugs in a venue and then becomes intoxicated as a result of that, they shouldn't be served. And what you need to do is have the appropriate systems in place to make sure that that isn't happening. But I have to say, this issue isn't just about licensees. I mean, I'm calling on the overall standard of the application of those rules to come to be lifted. But this issue is also about safety on the streets. It's about security cameras and the appropriate monitoring package to sit with that, and it's also about creating safety zones for people to be dropped off and picked up from the city safely and monitored taxi ranks for that purpose
and decent public transport
absolutely. I mean, I think 24-hour public transport, particularly Friday, Saturday, has enormous merit. It will mean that people get away from the city safely and easily and when they want to, it's certainly something we've been talking about throughout the course of this campaign.
Okay, well, moving on from the hotelier side, you've obviously got more policies.
Indeed.
Other than that, now, childcare, that's another real hot potato at the moment, isn't it, with ABC Learning and now this New South Wales company falling in a heap. What can the City Council do about childcare?
Well, the City Council is already in childcare, and City Councils need to be in childcare because it's an important segment of the market, and it's a classic example of market failure without the participation of governments, be they local, state or federal. What we've argued for throughout the course of this campaign is for new capacity. It isn't just about picking up operations that are falling over. We need to make sure that we're delivering new capacity in the system. Now, my campaign surveyed all the council-run centres. There are 650 families on waiting lists for childcare in the City of Melbourne alone. And we have costed halving that list, that waiting list, and we've committed $2.5 million over the course of my first term, if I'm elected, to halving that list and creating a new centre. We think it'll probably be on the northern side of the city. Now, separate to that, we need to make an evaluation about whether these other centres are going to survive without government participation, but it's really important that we're not talking about saving, just talking about saving existing capacity. We need to put new capacity into the system as well.
Now, I noticed looking down this list of policies here, Advocacy House. What's Advocacy House?
Well, it's sort of similar to the model you have here at City Village. What we're trying to do is we're trying to bring together a range of community advocacy services and give them all a central backbone. So, you know, one lot of IT, one lot of bookkeeping, one front desk, one phone system, but allow each of the services, be the Migration Law Service or the Women's Legal Service, the ability to access that skeleton and some subsidised rentals. So
serviced offices for community groups is basically
effectively
what you mean.
Yeah.
Are there gay and lesbian policies, or do you think there are policies that are of interest to gays and lesbians, or do you think that at this local council level, that kind of being gay or lesbian, that your constituent being gay and lesbian doesn't actually factor into it so much?
Oh, look, there are certainly issues that are LGBT specific. We I guess, are focused on diversity more generally. I mean, we think one of Melbourne's great strengths is its diversity, and we've spent a lot of time talking about that, and that's certainly the feedback we've received from voters as well throughout this campaign. We've also said that we're going to support some of the smaller community festivals that currently struggle, and I know that we're going to see festivals from the gay and lesbian community coming across our desks in terms of needing support. It isn't just about Midsummer. It's about the other activities that are going on out there in the community, and we're very keen to, you know, see all those grassroots activities properly supported and supported in a meaningful way, rather than the sort of tokenistic here's $500, go and have a play. We'll actually, you know, put staff behind these things, staff resources, so that these events are given every chance they can to succeed.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Will. We're going to have to move on, I'm afraid, because this is a
shucks
fast moving magazine style show, and we've got lots of other things to get in tonight. What's your web address
so that people can... It's www.fowlsafreshvision.com.au.
And all your policies and everything else...
Absolutely.
...will be on there. Well, thank you very much for your time tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Will Fowles.
Cheers.
Cheers.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. If you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Informing, entertaining and provoking. This is The Rainbow Report.
Yes, you're listening to The Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9 with Doug Pollard. My studio guests tonight, Andrew Shaw and Andy Noonan. Now, as we've been hearing throughout the mayoral campaign, as we heard just now, the city has a problem with late-night drinking. The government tried a 2 a.m. lockout, but that was a dismal failure, and now there's a new initiative which some venue owners think is actually worse. On the line now is John Wayne, General Manager of The Market. Good evening, John.
Oh, good evening, Doug.
How are the clubs taking responsibility for addressing alcohol abuse and its impact on the city, and why don't you like what the government's trying to do now?
Well, I haven't sort of haven't really suggested that I didn't like what they're doing.
Okay,
now.
Fine.
But I think the industry is certainly very heavily regulated, and I guess there are some good operators and there are some bad operators. And liquor licensing are trying to, pick up the ball and make sure everyone's abiding by the rules and regulations of their licenses, from that angle. And I guess the other side of it is what happens out on the street.
One of the things they seem to be suggesting about what they're going to do next is increase liquor license fees for venues. What do they want all this extra money for?
Well, the information that I've sort of got suggests that that the liquor license system costs about $15 million a year to regulate.
Mm-hmm.
And they're suggesting that at the moment they receive just under $10 million from the state's 19,000 licensees.
Mm-hmm.
So the state government has a shortfall of about $5 million. So I think they want to increase the license fees to cover the shortfall that they have, because they have to increase the infrastructure to continue to regulate the industry.
This is not really a very good time to be asking people to throw more money at the government, is it?
Not really. The industry certainly gets pulled and tugged from all angles with people like APRA and PPCA, both sort of music industry, and they their fees have increased dramatically as well. So there are other bodies that are all wanting a piece of the industry.
John, this is Andrew Shaw here. John, what do you think is the major problem here? Is it that there aren't enough security staff within venues? Is it there aren't enough police? Is it the availability of liquor? You know, what is the problem, do you think?
I think they really need to look at the bigger picture and see why, you know, why all this happens. But I think within the venues themselves, they're fairly well controlled. But having a heap of bars and clubs in a particular area also attracts people from other areas that aren't perhaps quite as exciting, but the people don't necessarily want to go into the venues to share in that experience. They're happy to hang around on the street.
So you're saying that people come in to look for trouble?
I think they look for trouble, or they look for excitement, and it ends up in trouble. They have access to 24-hour bottle shops. I think they drink in their cars, in the car parks, and hang around the streets. And I think perhaps a stronger police presence, which has sort of been guaranteed as part of an initiative by the government, is going to sort of come about. And certainly since the 2 a.m. the temporary lockout was put in place, that police numbers have certainly been raised and police presence.
Is it true that such a thing as a late hour entry declaration can be served on you guys with very little notice?
On one hand, I think John Brumby suggested that they're not looking at instigating a 2 a.m. lockout, but then on the other side of the coin, they're trying to push through Parliament to give the Director of Liquor Licensing the power to impose a lockout without any recourse from the venues.
Right, that's just on the spur of the moment kind of thing. I mean, the director has to do it in consultation with the police chief, I believe. But they can simply say, okay, from now on, all the venues in this particular license classification, your lockout is 5 o'clock, and then you've got like, you know, or 2 o'clock or whatever, and then you guys have got like 21 days or something like that to apply against that. Is that correct?
That's what they're putting through Parliament at the moment. Mm. But I don't think it's been approved as yet, to my knowledge.
Andy.
Hi, John. One of the things that our last guest was pointed out was that adhering to intoxication laws is something that many venues may not be actually doing, and that could be fueling some of this violence. I mean, do you sort of see that could be a problem that might be stamped out?
The staff all have to hold a responsible service of alcohol. We have to have security on the door. People aren't supposed to be admitted if they're intoxicated. People actually, funnily enough, quite often get themselves quite together to get in the door and buy that first drink and then fall apart afterwards.
There's been some suggestion, though, that this responsible service of alcohol system isn't really working as well as it might. Do you think there's anything that you could do to make it more effective?
Well, I guess in here we use both our security staff and our floor staff to keep an eye out on what's happening with the patrons on the floor and the bar staff when they get to the bar. But pardon me, we have pretty good controls over what's going on in the venue and where people are at, and all the key personnel on the floor are all on two-way radios as well, so helps not too far away if something's going on.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, John, giving us an insider's look at from the other side of the fence, as it were, because we normally hear from politicians who want to put restrictions and things on. We don't normally hear from the licensees. And thanks very much for your time tonight.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. That was John Wayne, General Manager of The Market. We've got a few more messages I just want to get in. Hi, Doug. The Market has done well from our community in turning a blind eye to drug abuse. Oh, dear. Please don't give them a soapbox to roll back alcohol controls. Well, I'm not sure that's a terribly fair comment, but since I'm not a regular on the scene, I wouldn't know. That's from Nick. And Adam Stobbs, responding to Fiona's remarks about, yeah, we're calling it a sex party because we're being upfront about it and all the rest of it, he says, the station considered changing the name to Fag FM for the same sort of reasons. A shocking name everyone would know about. That was in 1996, and it was supposed to be a joke, but some people did like the idea. I don't know that I would have been sitting here if this station was called Fag FM. Well, on the other hand, I might be. Well, it's that time again. World AIDS Day will soon be upon us. So this week, Case Sera is taking a look beneath the bonnet at the films that have charted this seemingly never-ending epidemic.
Just a few weeks, it'll be World AIDS Day. Amazing, isn't it, that some 25-odd years since the dreaded thing appeared on our doorstep, and we're still dealing with issues around awareness and how to protect ourselves. By now, you'd have thought they'd have come up with a cure. The French or the Americans, or, goddess forbid, the two of them in the same test tube. While they are a whole lot closer to understanding how HIV works in the body and even have a raft of treatments, alas, there is no magic bullet. The health messages that branded a terrified generation and in the process redefined a sexual identity still stand today. Use condoms if you're having a nookie. Know the health of your gums if it's oral. And if syringes are involved, well, don't share. And that includes your toys too. Strangely, that's the exact opposite to the lessons we learn from Big Ted in play school. But then Big Ted wasn't into sex toys, and if he was, well, he certainly didn't tell us. Today, when I think about AIDS, I think of all the familiar faces that have just disappeared. Closer still are the many names. Patrick, Barry, David. None of them made it through, but they all went out with an almighty bang. One got involved in the protest group ACT UP, even deflowering the famous floral clock to draw attention to issues around HIV drug access. Another took seasonal holidays to a small Greek island, cooked lavish racks of roast lamb, and taught himself Italian so he could decipher Michelangelo's poems. I came across the third as a name sewn into the memorial quilt one year. It was a stunning panel with pink sequin flowers and a lock of hair. At least I think it was hair. It could very well have been that mangy old acrylic bonnet that she sprayed the shit out of before each gig. I love her for that because, true to her drag spirit, she insisted on having the last laugh. I also have fond memories of the string of films that surfaced in response to dreaded AIDS. Bill Sherwood's Parting Glances was an indie classic. It uncovered a gay, yuppie love triangle and arty culture in New York in the 80s, which ended up being even more scary than the AIDS itself. It also featured a soundtrack by Bronski Beat with Jimmy Somerville screaming at the top of his lungs, "Tell me why!" Longtime companion was slicker and kinder. It starred gorgeous Campbell Scott with Mary Louise Parker as his straight gal pal. There's a very funny scene in it where Mary Louise and Campbell wander into a closet to pick out a burial outfit for their friend who's just passed away from AIDS, and they discover this outrageously coloured caftan. "Oh, it needs a hat," says Mary Louise in her southern drawl. There were other moving stories to come out of the AIDS era. Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart, Tony Kushner's Angels in America, Jonathan Demme's Philadelphia, which actually scored an Oscar for its star, Tom Hanks. Although, sadly, Tom and his spunky on-screen stick Antonio Banderas could barely manage a decent kiss for the whole of the movie. So there's much sadness, but also great inspiration that peppers the HIV/AIDS decades. And the common trauma of the time, the rallying together, the fundraising and silly games with condoms, the meetings and films and plays and books and really getting down to thinking about who we are over and above sex, all of that forged our sense of community. And while it's hard to communicate that to young folk today who pretty much have everything at their fingertips, this queen ain't about to give up trying. I'm Kay Sarar, and tucked away in the back of a drawer somewhere, I've got a bunch of red ribbons, one for each year of HIV/AIDS.
What will be, Kay Sarar.
And that's it for this week. My thanks to my guest this evening, Fiona Patton of the Australian Sex Party. I've been wondering all day what constitutes un-Australian sex, but we didn't get a chance to ask her. Mayoral candidate Will Fowles, General Manager of the Market John Wayne, Rodney Croom down in Tasmania, Andy Noonan from Southern Star, which incidentally is now on the web, I notice, at ssstar.net.au at last.
Yes, it is.
And Andrew Shaw from MCV. Thanks to my very hard-working producer Bianca and technical producer Michael, and of course to you for all your messages and calls. And apologies to those of you who SMS'd in, but we just didn't have time for all the messages. I'll be back next week with another edition of The Rainbow Report.
This has been a Joy 94.9 News and Current Affairs presentation.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.